6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribe. And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. This is John Quinlan. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to have a fascinating look at the influence of the LGBT press in both national, regional, and local dimensions. And very pleased to have on the line in just a minute from down in Chicago, Tracy Baim. And Tracy is the editor of a couple of different Chicago publications, including Outlines and the Windy City Times, and she's the author of a remarkable new book called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of LGBT Community Newspapers in America. She's a nationally respected leader for decades, and has just a fascinating book that is full of illustrations and individual biographies and a lot of just right spot-on analysis that talks about this phenomenon. Also pleased to have a guest in studio, and I'm lucky you're here so I can get the phone number over to the other side, is Patrick Faribault, and of course somebody who's very well known here in Madison in both journalistic and community context. Patrick started a publication called Our Lives back in 2007, was it?
Yep.
And it's a bi-monthly publication that showcases the lives of individuals in the LGBT community to powerful effect. And it's just a fascinating way for both folks in our community and folks beyond, you know, to take a look at the realities of our lives. So, Patrick, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I should say, you're also a friend and colleague of Tracy's, is that right?
You know, I am. I met Tracy back when I was first starting Our Lives. We were at a conference together down in Chicago for Community Marketing, which is a company based out of San Francisco that kind of, I would say, sets the gold standard for doing market research in the LGBT community. So connected with Tracy there, and she's kind of been somebody that has been very available and accessible to lean on for mentoring as Our Lives has grown.
Yeah, I think she's been involved since at least 1983, so it's quite a long tenure there.
Yeah, I think I want to say that the Windy City Times just celebrated over 20 years, so maybe 25.
I'm wow. Sure.
Yeah, and I know that that was really recent. It was over the past summer that I think I saw a bunch of press down in Chicago kind of recognizing her for being one of the groundbreakers in LGBT media in the nation. So it's kind of cool. I'm looking forward to catching up with her. I haven't talked to her in a while.
Well, as we facilitate a connection with Tracy, you're just back from quite an adventure.
Yeah, so I literally just got back from Washington, D.C. Last night. So it's great to be back in Wisconsin. As much as I liked being out there, I felt homesick which was a good thing, because not being natively from here, feeling homesick tells me that, you know, I really have a deep connection to this place.
Well, and folks, you know, yeah, feel a reciprocal sense too of you being a really important part of this community. It was fun to follow you on Facebook, though, and your adventures just in terms of visiting some of these famous Washington institutions. And you had this wonderful retrospective view of the reflecting pool and just kind of your own reflections on things.
It was great. And so the whole purpose of the trip was for now Senator Baldwin and Congressman Pocan swearing in ceremonies. And I got an invitation to come to the celebrations that immediately follow those ceremonies. As anybody who watched C-SPAN knows, the actual swearing-in takes place in the chambers of the Senate and of the House, so you can't be in there unless you are pretty much direct family. But after that, the people retreat back to either their offices in the House, in Mark Pocan's case, or to a larger reception hall in the Russell Senate office building for Tammy, essentially into a reception of friends and colleagues that have been heavily invested in trying to support and get elected these leaders. It was pretty inspirational to see. I have to admit, I even might have teared up a little watching Tammy come in. And when she came in, just how many people burst into cheers and how many people were entirely overwhelmed with emotion that it had actually happened. And the amount of people, even from the larger organizations like the Human Rights Campaign, the Victory Fund, I believe people from the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce were there. I mean, it was a large crowd.
Yeah.
So it's a real sense of our community and then and the community at large.
On a national perspective, yeah. Certainly on a Wisconsin perspective, I saw a lot of familiar faces. But then there were a lot of people running around with name tags that I was surprised to see in the room, including one person that I don't know if I should call him a party crasher or not, but Rep Paul Ryan dropped by to congratulate Tammy. So apparently they've had a good working relationship, obviously, from across the aisle and whatever stresses may come with that. But he wanted to stop by to congratulate the new senator.
And well, yeah, I guess they began their time in Congress together back in 98, and so they have those things they share. It's actually refreshing in this time of incivility to know that you can still have a civil relationship on that level. So
yeah, it was fun when he first walked in the room. You saw everybody looking to Tammy to see if it was okay, like, oh, can we interact? Is this all right that he's here?
Wow.
But and then Herb Cole actually made everybody chuckle. He gave a really touching, moving kind of. A speech before Tammy started speaking about how he felt about finally stepping down from office and how grateful he was that it was Tammy that was succeeding him in office. And he opened it by talking about, you know, what that moment was like for him when he was first sworn in and how taking over the seat from Proxmire had said that, you know, he knew that Herb was going to be a real model senator. And Herb said, you know, I don't know why he's using that word model. What's this supposed to mean? So he went and looked it up in the dictionary, and the definition of model was a miniature replication of.
Okay.
And then he understood.
Well, so, yeah, the seniority system's kind of pervasive, so it sort of makes sense that general jab would be there, too. It sounds like just a great adventure, and you had a chance to actually see Tammy and get her picture. And
yep. Tammy, I came to Wisconsin in 2005. The magazine launched in 2007, and it wasn't long after that I was introduced to and began building a relationship with now Senator Baldwin. And it is, I can claim that she has been one of the strongest mentors and role models that I've had, and watching how she has navigated through the system and how she has treated her relationship with the community and her role in the community has really provided a model of leadership, not just for myself, but really for anyone across the country. So, and she's aware of that, and she's very aware of that role that she's played in my life as well as many other people's.
Yeah.
And there's that unspoken nod of appreciation that we share, and it was nice to see her, you know, see me there, I guess, in a way, and nod that, you know, that relationship's continuing on, and she's still playing that role, even here locally, even though she's taken on a much bigger level of responsibility.
All right. Well, again, Patrick Farabaugh is helping us open the show here, and Patrick's the editor of Our Lives magazine, and he's got kind of a fascinating, I think, a very personal story, too, about what led you to this choice. And, you know, I was reading Tracy Beam's fascinating book. It just strikes me, you know, the personal is the political in every sense. And
I agree. I think that is especially true for our community. More so than many other communities, because we've had to go out to make our stories visible and accessible so that other people can recognize and relate to where the shared values are.
Okay. Well, Tracy Beam, I hear you've been patiently waiting on the line. Are you there?
I am here.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm sorry for the confusion at the outset here. Again, just to reintroduce to those of you who are just joining us, Tracy is the editor of a remarkable new book just out last month called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of LGBT Community Newspapers in America. She's also a longtime editor and writer for the LGBT Press going back to the early 80s, and just a great honor to have you on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. I love
Madison. All right. Hey, well, speaking of Madison, Patrick Farabaugh, who I know you know, is here also kind of giving us sort of a local perspective on some of this. But, you know, we here in Madison, during the height of the Capitol protests and other events that, you know, have had kind of a national prominence, it's hard for us to kind of get a fix on whether it's sort of our own, you know, local attitude, you know, our own local perspective that makes this stuff seem so important. So, you know, what Patrick was just describing, here we are in a city that has just seen the swearing in of both an openly gay member in the House of Representatives and an openly lesbian member in the Senate. What's the significance of that nationwide?
It's the first.
Yeah.
So, Wisconsin and Madison in particular have made history. that's not unusual. Wisconsin made history early on in the gay rights movement for gay rights laws statewide, and a lot of progressive politicians and issues that came out of Wisconsin. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book is I really felt like a lot of the successes that happened in the Midwest really often get overlooked when people write books about the gay movement. They focus on New York, San Francisco, L.A., and very rarely do they point to the really tremendous success that happened in the Midwest. And Wisconsin continues to make history, so this Baldwin is just really the next level, and that came from 40 years of work that happened in Wisconsin, you know, well before Tammy ever got elected. I met her first when she was first running for the very first local office many, many years ago. And it was thanks to activists back then that got her career off the ground. So it's really important to remember that lineage, which is why I wanted to do the book.
One of the things that Patrick and I were talking about as we were going on air, too, is, and I think this is important to establish, you know, because our audience is certainly disproportionately LGBT here in WARC, but we've had folks in the rest of the community who are supportive or who are maybe still on, you know, a journey of discovery, learning more about our community. Why is an understanding of this history and its significance, how does it impact on a larger community, not just the LGBT community, but why has it been significant for the rest of the country as well?
Well, I do feel like the gay rights movement, really, first of all, it happened thanks to previous civil rights movements. So if you're going to understand the progress on civil rights in our country, you have to look at gay rights as part of that progression, that the LGBT movement was successful in part because of the African-American and women's movements that came before it and somewhat paralleled it. So you can't look at civil rights in a vacuum. You can't forget that LGBT was part of that. I also feel like when you look at LGBT issues overall, they very much touch on all parts of society. And so when you're looking at things like domestic partnership benefits, those things benefit straight people too. If you look at hate crimes legislation, that affects straight people too. So I feel like a lot of the things that the gay movement has put forth as an agenda have really opened up opportunities for non-LGBT people too. The civil rights movement for LGBT rights is also unique in that we are a movement that has to self-identify. Very often, we can be hidden and have been hidden on purpose, whereas most women cannot pass as men and don't want to, and most African-Americans don't pass as white, although some had to for survival purposes. The vast majority of our community, probably 98% of it, used to pass very easily in mainstream society, which means that we had to have this extra barrier of self-identification that a lot of straight people didn't get. They didn't understand why we had to have gay pride parades and why we had to have gay newspapers and all these other ways that we self-identified. It was because we had to build our community almost from scratch. Our families, our niches, our communities, our physical places we lived, we had to create all of that stuff because we were so ostracized by society for so long.
You know, I one of the things I know that Patrick's talked about in conjunction with Our Lives is you, from the get-go, Patrick, I think, wanted a publication that was at home, not only the coffee shops or the coffee tables of LGBT people were frequented, but you wanted it to belong on everybody's coffee table. You wanted it to be something that...
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that I am critical of is when I see a business or an establishment claim to be for everyone. And I'm not entirely sure, especially when I see like nightlife organizations claim that's true. I don't think it's for everyone unless it can sit on the table of, you know, the lesbian mom as much as it would the person that goes out on a Friday and Saturday night to whatever local bar there is. But in that case, in trying to create a product that did reach that range of people, you know, Our Lives became the first media that I'm aware of in this state, LGBT media put into the public high school system. And I think it's one of the first in the nation that has been adopted and welcomed into the public middle school system. So the accessibility of our stories is expanded pretty significantly just by that, you know, it being... And another level to that I think about is also when a person is able to look and build their identity and how they understand their place in the world, I think it sends a powerful message when you go into a school or when you go into a mainstream establishment and see that you see yourself reflected in that by them affirming and putting your media on the shelf.
Yeah. Well, Tracy, this is sort of a broad question, but I mean, as Patrick's talking, not only just about the impact that the publications can have outside of the LGBT community, but within the LGBT community, I think back to Some of the publications that were out there in the mid to early and mid 80s, and how they've evolved in the scope of how they define community. In the late 90s, I was a managing editor for a couple of years of an LGBT parenting magazine, the first of its kind of the country, and we definitely had some of the same struggles that Patrick had in terms of wanting to define ourselves in a way that was broader and was defining community in ways that were maybe different. But whether it's women's and men's communities coming together or people with families, really the face of the LGBT press has really been reflective of changes in our community itself, has it not?
Yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, the sad part right now is that we are losing a lot of LGBT papers. But
yeah,
the ones, you know, the peak moment in the 1990s, really, we had so much diversity within the LGBT press. You had African-American gay publications, Latino gay publications, Asian. We had different age groups represented in different publications. And then there were the general interest publications like the weekly newspapers, the biweekly newspapers, where they like Windy City Times and Our Lives, try to reflect a wider swath of the community. But for a long time, a lot of the gay newspapers were very much one gender or the other, mostly white, mostly run by whites. So they weren't very reflective. In the 70s and 80s, it was more difficult to find that diversity. But I do think more papers, publications pay attention to that now as more and more people come out within all segments of our community. The community that most parallels the LGBT community, ironically enough, is really probably the disability community. Because they're about as diverse as we are, they're reflective in any part of society, and they have very little in common,
yep.
except when they come together to lobby on certain rights issues. But, you know, the hearing impaired community is very different than the visually impaired community. But, you know, oftentimes they can come together to work on the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example. But then they separate. And that unfortunately is true within the LGBT community. We, especially in bigger cities, live very separate lives from one another. In smaller towns, you have to work together, and they'll have fewer bars and fewer resources, so maybe you come together more often. But I often am saddened by how much division we have within our own community that we have yet to overcome, despite our other progress.
I wanted to go back, actually, to one of the things you were talking about with us being a community that passes and how that kind of creates some segregation, whether it's intentional or not. That's one of the roles that I see that the gay press of the future takes on is as I know when I was creating Our Lives, I knew that I would never have the resources to be able to do the kind of in-depth reporting that a media in Madison like the Isthmus could do. And the more the LGBT stories are becoming mainstream stories that are covered by like the Wisconsin State Journal and the Isthmus, I didn't think that I could be competitive in that area. So trying to evaluate the role that I could play with the gay media, was very personal for me. I had to assess what my needs were, hoping that those needs were shared across a community of people. And the needs that I was able to identify were that I needed people that could be role models to me and show me how to expect more and get more out of life. And with a community that passes, all of those people that were had the potential to be strong mentors and strong role models were invisible. So the goal of the media that I wanted to create and that I hope has longevity or the ability to have a long-term future would be creating something that could connect people to each other in a mentoring capacity and be that tool that connects a very disconnected and segregated community, both geographically and by whatever alphabet letter people choose to file themselves under, to each other. That way you can see what the shared experiences are.
It strikes me as Patrick's talking, this is really resonant with the point you were making at the outset, Tracy, in terms of connections to other civil rights movements and their traditions. Storytelling has always been one of the things that has been most transformative, that lifts up understandings, that cuts across the lines of communities that have been segregated from each other. And storytelling has had an enormous impact on the LGBT rights movement. Any thoughts on that and how that's played on the LGBT press?
Well, yes, I actually don't think there's enough of that.
Yeah.
I started a website called ChicagoGayHistory.org a few years ago to kind of address that lack of ability for us to pass on to our next generation. What Patrick said about his publication being in the schools is really critical because the vast majority of what LGBT kids and their allies learn about us is not from the schools. And I don't know that that's going to change in the short term. So it's really on it's kind of incumbent upon the older LGBT community to make sure that the next generation knows those stories. And so I'm actually on this kind of kick right now about making sure we're documenting those stories in a more permanent form for archives, and not just online. Online is important, but the problem with online is when websites go away, so does their content. So we have to have more permanent ways that we're documenting our community. In Chicago, there's this great project called the Legacy Project, where they've created these permanent display areas in the Boys Town area, where people will see the stories and legacies of people like Lorraine Hansberry and James Baldwin and other folks. Well, we just need more of that. We have current people who are like our James Baldwins today who are not getting the attention I think that they should in our schools. So we can, you know, hit our heads against the wall forever trying to make our schools change. But part of that is also on us to make sure that we're passing that legacy down through our media, through books, through movies, through whatever means we have tools at our disposal to get those stories out there, because there are millions of those stories, people that are still survivors of the pre-Stonewall era that are out there willing to tell their stories about what their lives were like.
That was the issue of the magazine up here that's coming out actually in a couple hours, ironically. One of the stories that I was really excited about and probably the most engaged in reading when the draft came in was the magazine was able to flush out a couple in Madison, because we have a couples list in our January issue that has been a gay male couple that have been together 51 years. And listening to this couple talk about, the draft for Vietnam and having to go in and acknowledge for the first time that you were an open homosexual to be able to avoid the draft and stay with your partner. For somebody who, like me, I'm 35 years old, and, you know, that wasn't really a part of my generation. That was incredibly moving to be able to have access to and hear that. And I think oftentimes our culture is still at a place where we are disconnected from the generations that came before us, and that history doesn't travel across those generations. So this has become something very personal to me, and it sounds like it certainly is to you too, and I'm hoping that that'll transcend even beyond to future generations too. Now, one of the things I was curious about, Tracy, is how do you think that the role of the gay press plays out in a city like Chicago that has gay enclaves, as opposed to a state like Wisconsin, where even in our urban cores like Milwaukee and Madison, we don't really have a neighborhood like Boys Town or Andersonville or anything that kind of creates the sense of place?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because very few gay people, well, the percentage-wise, gay people don't really dominate in any one. While they dominate in Boys Town and Andersonville and Rogers Park, they're everywhere. So, and most people that are really out for many, many years, they're really jaded about the gay community. They don't necessarily aren't reading the gay press every week. The people that hunger for the gay press news are probably, a cross-section of newbies and younger people, older people that just love newspapers, period. But our core has never been in just the gay areas. We are far suburban distribution in the Chicago area, and certainly online we have people reading it from all over the country that are current or former Chicagoans, that want to hear about the news from Chicago. A friend of mine in Australia, she said the City Times is the only paper she reads because she wants to know about the gay news. So, we have never only been in one place, let's put it that way. So it may seem easier in a bigger city, but sometimes that just complicates it because people are so kind of not post-gay, because I hate that phrase. I don't think there is such a thing as post-gay, but they may think of themselves that way, that they don't need the gay community anymore, even though when they get bashed or when they lose their job or custody or something, they'll come to the gay organizations for help. In many ways, they live this lifestyle that is so accepting. They can go to a straight sports bar, for example, in Chicago, and not have to go to the gay bars. The gay culture is changing at a huge rate. Men's phone applications like Grindr are changing the gay bar culture in Chicago. So the gay bars, some that were very popular years ago, are having trouble sustaining their clientele. So I would say that all institutions, all gay institutions, are kind of going through a change, some of that internet-based, some of that economy-based. And some of it just realistically, as people become older, they may move out of these areas of town that are more highly concentrated and want to live in more quiet areas or raise children. And that's always been the case. Like in the 1980s when I started, there were gay and lesbian suburban groups in Chicago area that were for people that were older and raising kids. So it's not a new thing. It's just probably larger numbers of people that are doing it openly, so that there are more stories for us to cover that reflect those that change.
Some of the challenges you talk about, I think, are really resonant with LGBT community centers. I was the director of outreach, the group up here, until about 5 or 6 years ago, and our challenge was how we certainly wanted to fulfill that purpose of being there for somebody who was coming out or somebody who was in crisis, but how did we develop programs that and community building projects that spoke to people who'd been out for a long time. Part of Patrick's stories, I'm sure you're aware, Tracy, too, is that one of the things that he wanted to do when he moved to Madison was create sports leagues, create other venues, business associations, places where people could connect. So, I mean, it just strikes me that it's not that folks aren't looking for community. It's just that maybe the bar is higher in terms of them wanting something really substantial that you offer in terms of community. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Patrick is very similar to me, even though I'm 15 years older. I started the Dan Lesbian Chamber in Chicago in 1995, I think it was, and I was on the Gay Games Board when it came to Chicago and played in the gay sports leagues for many years. What's great about the larger the city, the larger the opportunities you have to kind of self-segregate, and that's what that's what's happening more. That's what I mean. We have this massive community, but it's so difficult to pin down, unless it comes to something like, lobbying for marriage or lobbying for these kind of all-encompassing issues, then you get more of a across-the-board support. But usually what's happening is any day of the week you can do something LGBT in Chicago area on the north side, south side, suburban, and you can go through your whole life never interacting with someone who's not like you.
Yeah, that
not white gay man or a black lesbian or whatever it might be. You can self-segregate the larger the city, is.
That you're describing the life that I feel like I'm living often. I have to remind myself that there are straight people out there. but one of the things that I've noticed, and I'm curious to get your input on, is you had mentioned how gay apps like Grindr are changing the bar scene in Chicago. And I think they're actually changing something larger than just the bar scene, where when I look at how our struggle for civil rights and a sense of community, where we intersect with different racial minorities' struggles for their civil rights in places of intersection, is oftentimes the foundation of that identity comes from what brings, specifically focusing on racial relationships here, the context situation. What brings that, let's say African-Americans, what first brought them into contact with white Americans, or Japanese or Korean-Americans, what first brought them into contact with white Americans. And then the identity of that racial relationship comes from what provided that contact situation. And I can't help but think that there's a contact situation for gay Americans as well, but it's inverted. It's not what brings us into contact with people different than us, because we're a group that's born into people different than us. It's what provides that initial contact to people like us. And as long as things like bars, historically, or I think as we're moving forward, these apps for men that provide that contact situation, that context situation has a lot of power over telling us how to construct what we value about our identity. So I see the role of our lives as trying to provide a context situation for people too, especially if it gets to them in the schools first, that helps show them a more well-rounded sense of who they are as they're constructing what they value and the order that they value the different segments of their identity.
Tracy, your thoughts?
You are right on target, and as a lesbian, I often have tried to avoid speaking in a moralistic tone on that issue, because it's far more complex than morals, right? It's really more political. And this happened in the era of AIDS around the issue of phone sex ads. Ads were, when deregulation happened in the early 90s of the phone industry, phone sex became this huge advertising base for a lot of gay publications. And the publication I was running, I said we didn't want that to overwhelm the image of the publication.
Yeah.
We didn't want it to be all white young men shirtless in the paper. And I actually said to the men on the staff and our board, I said, I don't want to make this decision, though. As a lesbian, I don't think that's my decision to make. And the men actually agreed, the vast majority of them agreed, that it would really detract from what we were trying to do as a newspaper, to be basically a sex magazine. And so we did turn down advertising, and it hurt us immensely for many years, but it was still the right thing to do. I believe for our long-term survival, we also didn't rely then on any one industry to prop us up, so we weren't as vulnerable when the phone sex advertising, it pretty much died. died once the internet became big. So, you know, I agree that there's been some really good columns of late that I've been reading about this topic of this grinder generation, this manhunt generation, where they're really, that's the only place they're intersecting with their gay community, and they're not getting a better sense of who they are. So for some, it's probably just a healthy, you know, alternative way to cruise. But for others, if it's the only engagement they have, they're getting a very distorted picture of who they can be as full human beings, and to sustain a long-term relationship, if that's what they want, will be more difficult down the line.
I feel like, so I just came back from Tammy Baldwin's swearing in to the U.S. Senate, and I felt like that's what I wanted to thank her for more than anything, for being visible and showing that there's this path to being a more well-rounded leader that, you know, wasn't what they're probably experiencing on these apps. And where I feel very passionate and personal is that I think once somebody does achieve Tammy Baldwin's level or Mark Pocan's level or even levels that are a couple steps down from that, there's this perception that they're untouchable or inaccessible. And I want our lives to be a tool that helps provide that sense of connection where you can go from where you're at, maybe just discovering those apps or to seeing what the next few steps are to reach the place that a Senator Baldwin is at.
Yeah. There are a couple of threads I want to catch here that we can move into a little bit. You know, what you're both talking about just now, I think, is maybe striving for some kind of a hybrid where we can use the tools of social media, the great new ways that we can communicate and form that kind of virtual community. But I think it's got to be in combination with an actual sense of personal connection. Those are the connections that are genuine and that tend to work over time. And certainly LGBT Press has an important role there. So let's hold on to that for just a second. But I wanted just to engage a little bit in terms of the intersection here with history. Before I do that, just let me reestablish for those of you who are joining us here in midstream. Again, our guests in studio are Patrick Farabaugh. He's with Our Lives Magazine, a Madison-based publication statewide and beyond in circulation, biweekly publication that tries to capture authentically the stories of LGBT people. And also Tracy Baim, who is the author of a remarkable new book called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of LGBT Community Newspapers in America. Tracy is based out of Chicago, where she's been involved with such publications as Windy City Times and Outlines. But one of the things you cover in your book, Tracy, I think is really important. It's that if the press hadn't been there, the LGBT press hadn't been there, history itself, in many ways, would have been distorted. We wouldn't have captured a lot of the essence of what's happening. Before I let you in on this, one thing I want to make sure to do at the outset for those of you who are in Wisconsin is just acknowledge that we have our own history here. In this course of a national book, of course, there's only so much you could do to one of the 50 states in terms of covering some of this. But I just want to mention in passing, going back, there's a great page on the website of the Milwaukee LGBT history pages that lists, I think, almost two or three dozen publications over the years. This goes back to the work of Eldon Murray and a collective that produced a publication called Amazon in the early 70s in Milwaukee. Also, Out Magazine and Hag Rag here in Madison in the 80s. Other LGBT publications, you know, since then, like the Wisconsin Light, Instep, the current Wisconsin Gazette out of Milwaukee, also a statewide paper. Also in the realms of television, radio, Query here on WRT, your show. I'm sorry.
That's okay, being authentic on the mic.
So anyway, there's a whole realm that we wanted to cover. So now back to history. just to that point, Tracy, could you talk about, as you explore in the book, you know, one of the things is if we let AP or other mainstream sources, the news magazines, capture the essence of LGBT history, there's a richness there, a perspective that really would have been missing. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, even today, you cannot rely on the wire services or the other paper, the mainstream press, to cover the LGBT community in its full diversity and richness. They do it a far better job. It's not even comparable to what they used to do. But they still have an inability to go in depth in any one segment of society. That's why they're general interest publications. But the book starts with talking about how absolutely horrible the coverage was of the LGBT community, even going up until the 1980s. The mainstream media was so off kilter when it came to covering these issues. So the first part of the book is this whole in-depth look at some of the examples of how the New York Times, Harper's Magazine, Time Magazine, Life Magazine, all those publications, how they, when they weren't ignoring us, they were really just vilifying us. And it wasn't just the newspapers. They were, of course, covering when the federal government was calling us perverts and firing us from our from jobs in the federal government. So the legacy of mainstream coverage of the gay community is just horrendous. I'm sure that it parallels how bad it was when they were covering African Americans as well. This book happens to address the LGBT community, but many books have been written on the issue of women and African Americans coverage as well. So that's what created this need for the gay press. So it was sort of chicken and egg. Gay community certainly needed its own voice, regardless of how the mainstream media covered us, but it certainly accelerated that need once in the 1950s especially we started to have a few longer-term, longer-lasting gay publications. So that's kind of the, while the first gay paper was in Chicago in the 1920s, it lasted two issues and there aren't any copies left. There was another lesbian paper that started in the 40s that only lasted 10 issues. So in the 1950s was really when finally we had some long-standing gay publications, three of them that lasted into the 1960s. And then by the 60s and 70s, we started to have dozens and dozens more across the country that really, some of them even are still around today.
Okay. For those of you who'd like to join in our conversation, the number is 608-256-2001. Again, our guests, we have Patrick Farabaugh in studio from Our Lives Magazine and Tracy Baim, the author of Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of LGBT Community Newspapers in America, joining us on the phone from down in Chicago. Of course, you know, in terms of our history, one of the most notable examples of all of this is the AIDS crisis. Lisa Keene in your book writes, back in the early 80s, many gay men died because of the spread of HIV, but many more would have died had it not been for the urgent reporting every week in gay newspapers distributed through the LGBT community. Your thoughts on that, Tracy?
Oh, absolutely. When I started in Gay Life newspaper in 1984, there were fewer than 100 cases of AIDS diagnosed in Chicago. I very much feel like I was dropped into the middle of a war zone to cover the community. I was taking photos of men, and they were gone within weeks. And even many of them had gallows humor, saying, you know, this is going to be the photo you use for my obituary. It was really the most tragic of times. And I know that the gay press had an impact there. Some gay papers were a little slow on the uptake because there was so little known in the first couple of years of the epidemic. But I feel like the gay press it's an unremarked upon part of that early years of the AIDS epidemic. Whether it was covering, you know, the protests or whether it was covering the activists who were doing the work of the scientists at the time where they were pressuring the NIH, we were sending our reporters around the country to different protests at national headquarters or meetings. Part of what the gay press did during that time was not just document the Holocaust, but also give validation to the activists who were otherwise shouting in a forest with no, you know, they were the tree in the forest without anybody covering them. So I do feel that the media coverage of what they were doing kept them empowered to get through that next hurdle, to make it to, you know, to make it to the next protest, et cetera. So it wasn't, you know, the AIDS activists were just an incredible force of important work. The gay press also was important in covering what was happening and lobbying and editorializing. You know, the gay press has been accused of being an activist press, but I don't know what that means. I mean, I think any newspaper is an activist in some sense just by documenting what's going on. And certainly back then, every week we were writing editorials about the need for more AIDS funding, the AIDS housing, AIDS feeding people with AIDS, covering the activists. You know, whatever it was, there was just such a tremendous need. So I feel it was kind of an honor as a really young person. I started at age 21 covering the epidemic. It was an honor to have had the chance to meet some of those courageous heroes before they died. Some of them did survive the epidemic, but many of them were lost, and people that were either my age or just slightly older. I don't think a book can even capture how incredible that was as a journalist to cover and make sure those voices were not forgotten. You know, part of what we do as journalists is put something down for history, you know, in 40 years, 50 years from now, for people to use it and see what it was like. And I do feel it was quite an honor to be there and document that era of our gay movement.
Something resonant, I guess, with the here and now, you both comment on this, but we'll start with Patrick, if we could. You know, as Tracy's talking about the role that the LGBT press played in terms of growing awareness of AIDS, where some of that was internal communication and education about the nature of the challenges around AIDS. With young people today, we're often remarking that there seems to be sometimes a lack of knowledge or awareness. There seems to be, especially if your sense of community is through someplace like Grindr, you're not necessarily hearing from older folks or other folks who can give you perspectives. So does what you do also perform an important role in trying to educate folks in the here and now?
Definitely. I feel personally, again, I'm 35, so I kind of feel like I'm in this middle generation where I wasn't directly affected by the AIDS crisis the way people were in the 80s. I was a little too young still. But I'm still also able to have access to an insight into who you're calling the young people in this case.
Sure.
And it's scary for someone like me who didn't even experience the AIDS crisis to see just how cavalier younger people are, that they don't even think about it in that case. And I don't know how to connect them to those people. I try to use the magazine in a way to create that mentoring and that insight into the way things were, to create some of that succession of history. But I don't know how to revisit that in a way to make it relevant to a generation that didn't grow up living it with their peers.
Tracy, any thoughts on that? And are some of the new technologies, the social media, the other things you're mentioning, your own publication is now probably read more online than others. Are those potential ways that we can reach a younger group, a younger generation?
I mean, there are some innovative programs that are happening. We, for the 30th anniversary of the start of the known AIDS epidemic, we did a 13-month series on AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And we had young people write essays about what AIDS meant to them, and we interviewed a lot of people of all different generations. We did some historical pieces on it. It was really well received, and then we put it together in one big PDF for people to download at the end of the series. What's interesting is then the next series we did, which just ended last week, was an 8-part series on Generation Halsted, what we called kind of the next generation of LGBTQ folks. And really, for the at-risk youth, AIDS is a far-off worry. And what worries, you know, for them, believe it or not, in the middle of a big city with amazing gay community, is issues of homelessness and where their next meal is going to come from. So until we deal with some of their day-to-day survival issues for some of these at-risk youth, selling themselves on the street, prostituting themselves, or otherwise, you know, trying to find a way to get a meal is their priority, not safe sex. So there's some really terrific work going on in Chicago, and we feel like our role is to make sure we document that and let our readers know about it in case they want to support it. Chicago House, for example, they're an AIDS housing institution, but what they decided to do last year is create a transgender house. So these are not people who are HIV positive necessarily, but they're people who are at risk of getting it if they don't get permanent housing. You know, so you have to address all these other underlying other needs. So again, our role as gay media is really to shine a light on the innovative stuff that's happening so that it can get more support, you know, just continually. So I agree, reaching the next generation about AIDS is a difficult task, but it was a difficult task in the 1980s when people felt it was all sex negative and, you know, oh, you just don't want me to, you know, be free to be who I am. And, you know, there was a lot of pushback to activists back then. So our goal is just to, you know, cover it, make the information available, and hopefully it sticks to as many people as possible. It affects them, and they have safer sex and live long and healthy lives. But you can't moralize or force people to change if they're not going to.
I will say one of the challenges that I've had, I think the most moving pieces that I've been able to publish in the history of the magazine was a young person. I want to say he was maybe 21, maybe underage, even like under 20, underage being under 21, approached me online. He messaged me 2 weeks or so after he tested positive, just really an emotional mess, for lack of a better word. Like, he was really distraught and really kind of feeling lost and not able to process any of the overwhelmingness of what he was feeling. And I asked him if he would consider just writing about what he was feeling, and he did. He wrote a letter about what he was trying to process and work through, having just tested positive. And at the time that I published it, the magazine was still very insulated to the gay community. So there was some level of protection that he felt he was afforded by having this published, that only other gay people were going to read it. As the gay press is going more and more mainstream, and I'm picking up readers who are, you know, external to the gay community, I'm noticing that those stories aren't as quick to come forward. Like, I'm having a harder time having people accept and feel willing to tell those very vulnerable stories that I think are needed to be told and heard, because now they're worried about who else may read it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. We've had people that, you know, they're worried about their job status 5 years after we've run a story and it's still online.
Yeah.
They ask us to change it. And if someone's at risk, we will change it or use a pseudonym. But it is interesting. We've had profiled transgender people who no longer want to be known as transgender activists. They want to simply live their life in their gender of choice. So yeah, it's a difficult thing that it's, people realize now that it will live forever.
Yeah.
in online. So we have interesting things to navigate that we didn't used to have to do that.
As Patrick speaks of somebody who lives in fear because of concerns of the stigmatization and the violence, or the other, you know, implications that are still there for a lot of folks. I want to contrast that with, I think, this some dichotomous statements. I think some of the folks that write in your book talk about. They talk about maybe moving into potentially the last stage of the LGBT rights movement. You know, there's definitely transition here, but it reminds me, I guess, again, coming back to the civil rights parallel. Yes, you know, this is a time of enormous progress. But that doesn't mean that we don't still have a long way to go in many rural areas and in parts of the country that don't have gay rights protections, just in all kinds of different dimensions. Somehow we've got to keep the fire lit, despite that. Is that part of the challenge of LGBT press moving forward, Tracy?
Yeah, I mean, besides just utter survival as print publications, that's our probably biggest struggle facing us. But I do agree. I mean, if you look at what's happened in the African-American and women's movement, we are very similar to those in that, believe me, women do not have equality in this country.
Sure.
And neither do African-Americans. And there are still violence, there are still hate crimes, there are still, you know, horrible situations to both those communities. And so I don't think that, I don't know how you gauge success and progress and kind of the end line, where are we going to? Because nobody's ever succeeded wholly, right? So nobody's ever reached that holy grail of complete and full equality with the straight white male wealthy class, right? So how do you gauge it? So I do believe there's been tremendous progress in many, many areas. I've been lucky to be able to cover the community for these 29 years and witness that progress. But I don't know what our end game is. There was a book that came out last year that basically said we were at a point of victory. And I totally disagreed with the premise of the book.
Yeah.
And kind of vilified it in a review because I felt like they didn't get how difficult it still is for most LGBT people to navigate full and complete healthy lives in our society. There is a small, small percentage that do that are lucky enough to both have family support and work support and partner support, et cetera, and live open and healthy lives. It is not a majority, in my humble opinion, is not anywhere near a majority yet. Marriage equality is an interesting battle.
Yeah.
I don't really support the government having any role in any private relationship between two people, but as it does with heterosexuals, it should be equal with gay people. And the one thing I do understand about the marriage equality movement is that it has moved our movement probably 2 to 3 decades further along.
Yes.
Than we would have been without it. Meaning that the images you see of couples the other 51 years, like Patrick said, are so changing of our society's view of gay people. Pride parades never could do that, never could do what having an African-American lesbian couple on the cover of a mainstream newspaper kissing in Iowa, having a marriage. I mean, that changes society in ways we could never do through a lot of the traditions that we have been fighting for. So I understand and appreciate marriage for that reason, for pulling along all the rest of our movement and our issues so much further along. But we have a long way to go. Even if we had full marriage equality after the Supreme Court, you know, hears us this year, even if we have that, we still have, I believe, at least a couple more decades of very difficult, tumultuous time of kids getting kicked out by parents who don't support them, of kids committing suicide, of bullies killing people. I just don't see. I'm optimistic, but I'm also really realistic that we have a long way to go.
You know, and I just off of that, I you know, I think this is resonant with what you're talking about, the history of AIDS. We took something that was that mainstream culture was using to stigmatize and to keep us down, and we told stories of created families and support and you know, other things that were inspiring, were uplifting, that captured the best of our character. The same thing with family rights. When you see the kids in our families out there speaking and talking about mom and mom and dad and other combinations thereof that are you know, are so important to them, and that, you know, just these fundamental truths and everything. There was a time, I think, in both cases where we internalized the notion that it was dangerous, it was risky to get those images out there because they're in the case of you know, family rights, there were still people that wanted to invoke molestation myths and all kinds of other. Things that just were not true, were not authentic, and you know, so we hesitated to do that. I think maybe the juncture we're at now is we're realizing the power in those stories, and we're getting ourselves out there in ways that we hadn't before. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Patrick, you had something?
No, I mean, a lot of the work that I'm trying to focus on is, as people move into what you may consider that post-gay phase, how to re-engage them and still show them that not only do they have something to offer, but that their voices are still needed, so that they don't disengage and segregate into whatever communities that they're in, or integrate, I should say, into whatever communities that they're in. I'm using the magazine to try to do that, to say, hey, here, we need to hear your story, and that story is going to be told to this next group that is coming up, that is looking to know that there are people out there that have made successful, happy lives for themselves.
We're down to just our last 5 minutes or so, but it's impossible to capture the essence of this book, but the one thing I wanted to make sure we did, and I think the two of you are living this out by sharing what your own personal stories and commitment are, but I know it's safe to say with Patrick that the economic challenges, the difficulties in getting something started, they produced a toll on you, and they were quite difficult. Tracy, I'm sure the choices you've made, you could have gone a different route that would have been more financially productive, but that sense of community led you in a different direction. Could you just reflect briefly on how that's reflected in some of the stories that you tell in the book?
Yeah, you know, I'll sound like a martyr in this sense because I chose my path, but boy, oh boy, it was entirely unpredictable and difficult path. You know, my own parents were both, my father, Steve Pratt, was in traditional media. My mother was booted out of traditional media because she was a woman and did non-traditional media. So I had both paths for me to see. And I chose the non-traditional media. I'm really glad I did. I have absolutely no regrets, but yes, the economics of it are just crazy, and continue to be. You know, after 29 years of doing this, it's still a juggle and still a struggle. But I don't regret it, and I feel very, very lucky in this day and age to still be doing what I love. Part of the reason I wanted to do the book was to reflect back on the good and the bad of it and the struggle of it for those who cared to kind of see how it was, even and before me, even more difficult for the people in the 60s and 70s. But then also to kind of assess where we are today and do we have a chance of surviving into this new age of media. So, I'm an ever optimistic person, even though I sound probably kind of cynical. I do feel that there's a role for gay media to continue to play, but we have to adopt and adapt to this new way. And I think Patrick, with his publication, is doing a great job of kind of seeing the past and the future at the same time. He has a very clear vision for what his publication is, and I think a lot of gay media out there don't have that clear vision right now. They haven't made the transition to what their readers want now versus what they may have wanted 20 years ago in a weekly newspaper or a biweekly. Our newspaper, what we put out in print, is only a small portion of what we produce every week. The vast majority of what we produce is online, and those stories that are breaking are online. They're not as much in the newsprint anymore because breaking news doesn't even make sense in print form.
But is there, with just a couple minutes left, sir, go ahead.
I was just saying, so you have to change with the times or you're going to be left behind.
I'm just wondering, is there also a positive in the sense of the interactivity that these new media bring you?
Oh, absolutely. On Facebook, I get immediate response for stories and on Twitter as well. So I think that we can utilize those to our advantage and just have to figure out a way to monetize it all so that we can survive as companies.
I can tell you, first of all, I don't know if I've ever said this to you, Tracy, but you're certainly a role model that I've looked to, and many times when I've tried to understand and relate to the work that I'm doing. So thank you for that. And I've often had to step back far enough to realize that compensation doesn't always mean money. Like, the people and relationships that I've got from the work that I'm doing are significantly more rewarding than anything that I've done in any other work in my life.
Absolutely.
All right. I think we're going to close out now with just a minute left or so, but again, I just highly recommend Tracy's remarkable new book. It's called Gay Press, Gay Power, The Growth of LGBT Community Newspapers in America. Tracy, is there a central website or a place where people can find out more about that?
You know, it's available on Amazon through a color edition, a black and white edition, and on Kindle. I don't have a website except for Windy City Times website, where I do have a press release up. But
okay.
Amazon pretty much has all the basic information where people can get it.
I know. Just Googling Gay Press, Gay Power will get you a lot of those sites. So we hope there's... Hey, thanks so much for joining us. Patrick Faribault, also Our Lives magazine, again, available online. Could we play that closing music here? Something that I thought was just sort of evocative of, again, the greater meanings around LGBT press in our culture. This is... Broadway. It's not just for gays anymore. Thanks, and everybody have a great week.
If you've seen a show, then you already know how magical theater can be. It's a 2-hour live action, barely affordable, unlip-synced version of Glee. So this song goes out to the rest of you, those who've never seen theater before. Because Broadway has never been broader. It's not just for gays anymore. If you feel like someone that this world excludes, it's no longer only for dudes who like dudes. Attention, every breeder, you're invited to the theater. It's not just for gays anymore. The glamour of Broadway is beckoning straights, the people who marry in all 50 states. We're asking every hetero to get to know us better. Oh, it's not just for gays anymore. It's for fine, upstanding Christians who know all the songs from Greece. It's for sober-minded businessmen who yearn for some release. So put down your Playboy and go make a plan to pick up a playbill and feel like a man. There's so much to discover with your different gendered lover. It's not just for gays, the gays and the Jews. And cousins in from out of town you have to amuse. And the sad and bittered malcontents who write the reviews. And also foreign tourists and the groups of senior citizens and well-to-do suburbanites and liberal intellectuals. Though that group is really only Jews and homosexuals.